So let me continue my biting of the bullet here. So my argument now is that, in fact, I'm happy with the deduction because I'm happy with the claim that every object is potentially regardable as beautiful, and the difficulty is always going to be not whether that is, my claim now is that every object must, that we can cognize, must be in principle experienceable as beautiful, and that there are, I guess, a couple of things we can say about this. First, let's think about Kant's account of wild beauty and the peppercorns. So I should now say that the notion of wild beauty that looked like a refutation of the claim that every object is beautiful. In fact, that argument doesn't say that, because Kant acknowledges that the rows of peppercorns can be seen as beautiful. It's just that we will tire of their beauty, roughly because they're so regular, and that the wild, extravagant beauty is what? I would claim only provides a more reliable source of the experience of beauty, not, therefore, a necessary, wildness is not a necessary condition of beauty. Well, why is wildness more reliable? Because wildness does the work of abstracting from the concept for us. So that there are certain types of objects in nature, the wild ones, and in culture, the aesthetic ones, the art ones, that, as it were, do the work of abstracting from the general concept for us, and therefore allow us to remember what holds of every case for every object. And if we were to push this a bit further, there is a notorious argument by Susan Sontag in her great book on photography, where she complains about photography, that the problem with photography, she says, is that it beautifies everything. That take a picture of something and you can make any object look beautiful. I want to say that's fine with me, because what a camera does is give us a disinterested, because mechanical, account of the object. So every ordinary camera shot, ordinary now has to bear a lot of weight, our fascination with photography is that photography is the mechanization of disinterested judgment. Might put it another way, that cameras are naturally mimetic. Yeah.
Sounds like the reification of beauty.
It is. It has its own problem. I'm not saying it doesn't have its own problem. I absolutely agree it's the gratification of beauty, and it leads to all sorts of disastrous stuff. That's what Sontag's worried about. I'm just taking the other side of that. It is absolutely, the reason photography is a problem is exactly that it mechanizes beauty, so that it does the work of abstraction for you automatically.
No, it's I'm not saying up to the camera itself to
I'm saying the claim that Sondheim makes is every object qua photograph can be an act of beautification.
Photograph well, by a photographer.
That's what I'm saying. It's not...
But it's because of what I'm saying. Mechanism is a form of disinterest. That's how I work it.
It seems like it would depend on how it's wielded. Again, as you could, I mean, you seem to be linking up the disinterestedness to somehow the pleasure we're going to have in looking at the photograph, which means there's going to be beauty in the object as photographed in that way, but. Of course, you can take ugly photographs of things, and you still then you still have the machine, you still have the mechanization, so you still have the disinterestedness in terms of how you're defining it. But now you have ugliness, so how is that going to work?
It's a nice question. Is there a possibility of a truly ugly photograph? Stephen Melville says the problem with photographs is that they can never be wrong.
I just wanted to say there's lots of techniques for framing and technical.
That was my character's paradox.
But is it in terms of getting a sentimental reaction or anything that could preclude a beautiful judgment? I'm saying that the photographic or cinematic apparatus has many means at its disposal to frame a photograph such that you identify with it or have a sentimental reaction.
Right.
So you can judge it as beautiful.
It does. I'm agreeing with that.
But you could not judge it as beautiful.
Well, you could not.
Well, if you're having a sentimental, emotional reaction, that sort of precludes.
I see. I take it that Sontag's thought is something like, we know that it's often said that the power of painting is its capacity to turn ugly things into objects of beauty, of which the Laocoon is usually the standard example. And photography does that in a more routinized way.
I'm still not understanding the connection between mechanism and disinterest, because it seems that there are ways of making photographs of things that you can be highly interested, or some people could be highly interested in, like pornography, or a kind of less inflammatory example would be photographs of travel locations.
I'm not saying that every photograph is beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm saying that the structure of photography is the case of the possibility of the beautification of every object. So you think of, the kind of cases I'm thinking of are the Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, or James Knopfley's Inferno. Knopfley's Inferno is a startling book, right? Do you know this book? All right, James Knopfley is the leading documentary photographer of our time. You've all seen his photographs everywhere. And he photographs nothing but atrocities. James Knopfley, and there's even a wonderful documentary about him, because in the photographic world he's regarded as a kind of saint, because he goes and photographs every disaster, every atrocity, every misery. But he has, and this is why this book Inferno, it's a picture of hell on earth over the last 25 years, no matter what the picture is of, Romanian children in their terrible orphanages, Rwanda, it doesn't matter. Every one of them is exquisite. And it's made a great, there's a whole debate around Knopfley about a certain pornographic, right? Because he beautifies each and every atrocity. So I'm not denying, but I am saying there's something startling about that capacity of the photograph. Absolutely.
Over the newness and its originality.
Right. So why do we love the Walker Evans photographs? Because he makes the conditions of destitution beautiful. And making them beautiful gives the people back their dignity. Right? Isn't that the way you read that book? Isn't that how you read Walker Evans? What?
A really fine line between that and that making new and reification.
Absolutely, but I'm agreeing with that. I'm not denying any of the nasty things about photography, right? You're talking about someone who's written on Cindy Sherman, right? And what Cindy Sherman's doing is disenchanting photography. She's working against that very impulse of photography, right? She has to find the way of, as it were, making us unable to see it as beautiful is part of her whole strategy. You know, so I'm not denying any of that. I'm just talking about as evidence for that every object potentially beautiful, that photography is a way of thinking about how that practically has occurred.
Yeah. I'm interested more in this reification of sentimentality. And when I think of photos like Anne Geddes with babies and bonnets,
right,
and we're kind of reinforcing a stereotype we already have, how is photography making it any more of a visceral beautiful experience?
Look, photography can be the most stereotyping, the most reproduction of standardized images. I mean, I think that as a given. I'm not trying to say every photograph does it. I'm saying photography has potentially, the idea that every object is potentially beautiful is one of the impulses of the photographic mode. And it's because it attempts to find an appropriately, or some photographs do, mimetic relationship, right, between object and image. Yeah?
It seems as though this bit about all objects being potentially beautiful turns on some notion of novelty, right? So I'm wondering...
No, de-reifying, not novelty. It opens up the possibility of novelty. But what I'm trying to do is say that conceptual meaning becomes a stereotypical meaning and loses its relationship to its object. And the work, what art does, what beauty does, is return concepts to this pole of their meaningfulness.
Well, okay. I guess I don't really understand what you mean by that, then. Because in all of the examples we've been talking about, it's as though there has to be something unexpected, perhaps.
Absolutely.
New.
Absolutely. Well, that's logical, because concepts are old. Because concepts are saying everything that falls under them are the same, concept takes everything that's singular, new, and makes it old. So it's simply a logical truth that individual experiences strike us as new. But it also allows for the notion of actual novelty, which is what artworks do, right? Artworks want to generate new meaning by escaping from the rigidity of concepts. Yeah?
Just getting back to the work of the mechanism of the camera, it seems one could also say that the mechanism of the gallery does the same thing when, for example, you put urinal on a wall and we're forced to look in a gallery.
No, it doesn't make it beautiful, it just makes it art. Duchamp never claimed it was beautiful. He just claimed you could look at it and say, oh, that's an artwork. Needless to say, I think Duchamp was a fraud. That would be another argument. I'm a radical anti-Duchamp.
What about the painting as a framing device for a ubiquitous object, as in the tomato soup can? Is this also another example of the same thing?
There are two different ways of reading that. Arthur Danto thinks that what Warhol was doing was revealing the beauty of the everyday. I read Warhol in a much more cynical way.
More like Duchamp.
Yeah, more like Duchamp. But that's a whole debate. Okay, one last point on this is Dwyer criticizes my argument in his piece by saying, look, this business about lost pleasures is not about the relationship of concepts to objects. The lost pleasure, he says, when Kant uses that phrase, is about cases of genre, species and genre. That we no longer find pleasure in bringing species under higher generic ordering because we've gotten used to it. My answer to Dwyer is that in the first introduction, the relationship between species and genre and between concept and object are absolutely parallel. So I take it that what holds of one holds of the other. So I agree, he caught me on a textual claim that is not accurate, but I'd argue that the philosophical thesis holds because Kant is using the claims about the possibility of concepts in general and the possibility of moving from species to genre in exactly the same way. Okay, that's interpretation one of the deduction. All objects are potentially beautiful. Okay. Any questions about that one? Yeah.
Okay. So it seems like you gave us an interpretation and they gave us one possible interpretation of the interpretation, which is to say, you said up front, we're going to allow the possibility that all objects are beautiful. So in other words, we're going to use reflective judgment as sort of in a cognitive way.
Yeah, that is, I'm allowing that these two really are really proximate to one another.
So
the standard objection I'm saying is no objection. That's Kant's point.
Yeah. And so in this case, we go, here's intransitive meaning, here's transitive meaning. And your point, it seemed to be at that point, was anytime we're kind of finding the rule and then turning it into a concept, now we start to sort of fall away from the experience itself. Now this becomes sort of experience devoid of experience.
Exactly.
It seems like, I don't know, maybe a more analytical or some other mode, we could kind of read it the other way or give it a different interpretation, say, well, this just means that all reflective judgments are incomplete or unfinished cognitions, which is to say,
But I don't have anything against that.
But I mean, but if that's the case, then it's not that cognition sort of sells the object short, it's that if you're finding it beautiful or you find it sort of meaningfulness without meaning, it's just you're not finished yet. You still need to go forward and find the concept.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought I had a question in it.
But I thought this whole thing was about giving this an independence of its own.
It does, but I'm not denying that if this is a condition for this, right, then it's both independent, but it is completed here, right? I mean, it's part of the process of conceptualization. But I'm saying it's an aspect of concepts. So I am claiming that concepts have two axes, right? And that when we find concepts are fully meaningful, we have a sense that those two aspects of the concept are both operative. Ordinary experience, I'm claiming, uses or employs just a part of the concept. So what Kant calls the concept, I'm saying is only half a concept.
It seems that meaninglessness without meaning is just kind of, or meaninglessness without meaning is just kind of without meaning. It isn't fully, doesn't, it's just a matter then of cognition picking it up, right? And so it's valuable, but in as much as it shows something about real cognition, real conceptual thought.
Yeah, except in our world, we're always operating with only the one. So what we have, I'm arguing, is the difficulty of our world is I'm suggesting that what we rarely have is the whole concept. We sometimes do, and I can try to talk about the occasions when we do. But mostly, concepts are simply mechanisms for identification. We don't have, they save us the trouble of experiencing the object, because I know what it is. Conversely, what art tends to do is to take just this half of the concept and operate with it independently of this other side. So we have the kind of art we have because we have a broken conceptual regime. So why is aesthetics autonomous? I'm just autonomous. Those concepts are mostly dead. I made it maybe too political. Yeah.
I mean,
this is a whole sociology of modernity. Right?
On the retelling that Matt gave, it seems that we wanted to say that whatever we're getting out of looking at art, or whatever, you know, is coming out there, is somehow this less than full.
Absolutely. That's good. That's good. So we go to the artwork because our concepts have died on. And what we get in the artwork is so I read this novel and I say, yeah, that's what love is. But now I operate in the world by saying, no, that's phony love, that's inauthentic love, that's sentimental love. So against the background, so once my concept is rejuvenated by being bound to the appropriate kinds of experience, right? Then, yeah, my concept then is de-reified and suddenly viable again.
So then that's where the vitality comes in that we were talking about kind of at the end of last time.
Yeah.
I mean, at a certain point, though, can't this almost overcome this by taking it to another level and say that conceptuality itself becomes a new kind of material for aesthetic pleasure? I'm thinking conceptual art, thinking philosophy here, a sort of aesthetic pleasure you get out of the play of concept itself.
I don't know what to say because I don't. I mean, I always think conceptual art is dumb. I mean, no, because conceptual art is mostly concepts that if you're a philosopher, you think, I had that, you know, idea like 10 when I was 10 years old. Oh, come on, you know, give me a break. So mostly conceptual art seems to me like people who haven't bothered to study philosophy, I don't know. It really means nothing to me. I think conceptual art ain't art. It's a certain strangulated view. I can see where it comes from. But I think it picks up exactly the wrong moment. Why? Because it thought this moment was overly aestheticized, right? Conceptual art is simply a critique of Greenberg. That's what it's about. Right?
But there's also, like, I mean,
why is it Greenberg? Because Greenberg said the only place we can have this experience now is in totally abstract art. And then they said, well, look, abstract art is just as commodified, saleable. Come on, give me a break. Let's go back to concepts of the world and the gallery. You know, it's a conceptual art.
But it's not mere, like, the pleasure one gets out of an aesthetic. Like a conceptual work of art is not the same as like a math equation for most people. There's a chance to have an aesthetic feeling of beauty at least. So, is there
I don't think in conceptual art, I think in mathematics.
You know what a beautiful
I understand that phrase. Conceptual art seems to me wholly resistant to the idea of beauty. That's its point. That it wants to be art without aesthetics. And I'm trying to say the notion of, so what I'm claiming is the aesthetic is a dimension of conceptuality. That's my claim. So I'm claiming that the reason we're interested in art is because art is actually a source of meaningfulness, and it strikes us when it does because we've lost that relationship to meaning. Yeah.
So was the cliché once novel in the sense you're talking about? When we see cliché photographs, say, is that simply kind of was that once a novel experience or a novel?
Answer about clichés is who knows if they are once non-clichés. That they're clichés means that even an image can be non-singular. Right? So that's the genius of Cindy Sherman's early film stills, right? She shows that all these images of women, which are just every woman you've ever met, are stereotypes. And then that's terrifying, because then you think what it is to be a woman in America, at least in the 1950s and 60s, is only to be determined by a series of stereotypes, and there's no possibility for authenticity. So you watch these things, and they look like they are about nostalgia for certain movies, but they're actually a horrifying experience of the power of the cliché to determine identity. They're very dark. Yeah?
Can we think then of failure as conceptual art, which is kind of how I think of it a lot, is that it fails to demonstrate precisely the complexity that is the conceptuality of the aesthetic artwork in demonstrating both the unity of the concept embedded in form. And conceptual art seeks to go directly to the concept itself without the form. And that, for me, is one of the reasons why I pursue it originally. But it's failure.
But it comes out of a far more polemical gesture.
Right.
I mean, I agree with you, but it's actually based on a polemic with the notion of form as mere form.
Right.
And a certain thinking of that as a certain structure of commodification. Which is not false. Okay, interpretation one. I don't think we're going to get to the sublime today. We have two more interpretations to go. Okay, second interpretation of the deduction. This one is following Patrice Longuenesse. In that same essay I've talked about before. And it concerns thinking about the question of necessity and what Kant means by necessity and therefore universality. And it's going to argue, so it's going to go back to what we've dropped out of the account I just gave, is I've made no use of the kind of Ginsburgian normativity. So this is going to bring back a version of the Ginsburg normativity argument that we had about paragraph 9. Don't worry, I'll remind you. I know you're thinking, what the hell was that? I'll remind you. But you know it's something, right? Black box. Okay. What is necessary in an aesthetic judgment? Well, in the judgment, this X is beautiful. Is the necessity the relationship between the X and the beauty? That's one possible version of the necessity. Or is the necessity the connection between predicate and subject in the implicit judgment about all judging subjects, namely, in apprehending X, everyone ought to experience the same pleasure and thus agree with me. That is the necessity that everyone agree. So is the necessity, the relationship between the object and the predicate beautiful? Or is the necessity that everyone ought to agree with my judgment that X is beautiful? If the necessity is between the object judged in its form and if it's the first case, between object and beauty, then the necessity is between the object judged in its form and the pleasure I feel. Because the pleasure I feel is the source of my judgment, X is beautiful. If it's the second case, then the necessity is between the obligation assigned to all and judging subjects as such. That is, everyone ought to judge like me. Bring those two together. Now, in fact, in paragraph 18, page 237, Kant actually seems to say both. So he says it's not a theoretical necessity, nor is it practical. Rather, as a necessity that is thought in an aesthetic judgment, it can only be called exemplary, i.e. the necessity of the assent of everyone to a judgment that is regarded as an example of a universal rule that we are unable to state. Since an aesthetic judgment is not an objective and cognitive one, this necessity cannot be derived from etc. Okay, so the thought is both that the necessity is the pleasure I feel and the necessity of everyone to agree. In this case, however, in paragraph 18, it's the normative necessity that grounds the objective necessity. That is, it's the necessity that everyone ought to agree with me that grounds the judgment X is necessarily beautiful. So what we're talking about, so what Longuinus is interested in is two types of necessity. Let's call them objective necessity and normative necessity. And objective necessity is roughly going to be tied to the kind of necessity that's in epistemology. While normative necessity is going to be the kind of necessity you get as it was called quasi-moral. And Kant seems to be thinking about both. And the question is, how do they connect? Do they connect? Which one does he believe? What are we to think about this necessity? Well, as I just said, in paragraph 18, it's the normative, everyone ought to judge as I judge, that grounds the claim X is right, necessarily beautiful. So the thought there is, because all judging subjects ought to judge as I do, therefore, the relation of the predicate beautiful to the subject of the manifest judgment can be asserted as necessary. So the thought here is because of this that I can assert that necessity. How come? Well, the crux is to remember that what is beautiful is the object as apprehended. So being beautiful is the same as being judged to be beautiful, right? That's the Copernican term. To be beautiful is to be judged as beautiful. But to be judged as beautiful, so let me get that right. Let me say that again, because this is exactly how the two are going to connect. What is beautiful is the object as apprehended. And that entails that being beautiful is the same as being judged to be beautiful. X is beautiful. So, to say all judging subjects ought necessarily to agree with me is to say that the object ought necessarily to be judged beautiful, or that the connection between the predicate beautiful and the object is necessary. Okay, so the first thing Longinus wants to do is ground the epistemological in the normative. And the question is still open. Is the model here like cognition? Because I claim objective validity for my judgment, I claim. So you can do the argument the other way around, right? You can say, because I take my judgment to be objectively valid, that's the reason for me to claim that all judging subjects ought to agree. You can go either way. So we have both aspects. All judging subjects ought to agree. The object is necessarily beautiful. How are we going to figure out that relationship between the two? Does A ground B, or does B ground A? So is this a epistemology that's then being given a moral aspect? Or is it a version of morality? All rational beings ought to act in the same way as me. The first thing Longinus wants to say is certainly that both models are relevant. And how do we think, why do we think that both models are relevant? Well, the first is the epistemological argument. This argument is the argument from presupposed ordinary cognition to universal communicability, is analogous to, Longinus says, submitting oneself to the norm of truth in cognition. So to make judgments of taste, to be disinterested, judged by form alone, etc., is like analogous to judging for truth. So in that sense, the impetus for the aesthetic is like the impetus for truth stating. So paragraph 21, the very last sentence of the section reads, mm-hmm. last sentence of the section? I guess so. Okay. Hence, it would seem that we do have the basis for assuming such a sense and for assuming it without relying on psychological observations, but as the necessary condition of the universal communicability of our cognitions, which must be presupposed in any logic and any principle of cognition that is not skeptical. That is the whole reason there is we have to assume the sameness of our faculties if we're not to end up in skepticism. The problem here, as we've already discussed, is that the relationship between imagination and the understanding in cognition is a coerced cooperation. And the issue here is, what about such cooperation when it is not coerced? The coerced, she argues, is insufficient for the latter, as Kant notes in detail in paragraph 22. Now, Longuenesse says, at this point, let us shift from the idea that, let's call it common sense as presupposed, to the idea of common sense as what ought to be, using the moral duty model. And her argument here is, if the common ground is the same for both cognition and aesthetics, then Kant is open to the standard objection. And she thinks the standard objection is lethal for the cognitive view. But, she says, so this is now she's going to do something else with the standard objection. And everyone plays off the standard objection. So her thought is, what the cognitive view shows is merely a kinship and not a generic identity between the sensus communis grounding taste and empirical judgment. And she says the latter cannot ground the former. Universal community, she says, communicability in empirical judgment only entails that it is possible for the imagination and the understanding to agree when they are not rule governed. So all that the cognitive view shows is it's possible for the understanding and the imagination to agree when it is not rule-governed. Well, possible is not enough. So she says what we want to complement that possibility is the demand. That is, not that they do, but that they ought to be this agreement, and because we demand it, we make it as if a duty to bring about in ourselves and in others. So in paragraph 40, page 296, which you haven't read yet, that is... Kant says, if we could assume that the mere universal communicability as such of our feeling must already carry with it an interest for us, something we are, however, not justified in inferring from the character of merely reflect the power of judgment, then we could explain how it is that we require from everyone, as a duty, as it were, the feeling contained in a judgment of taste. Now, Longuenesse wants to say that what this points to is our interest in having a shared common sense. So her way of arguing it is to say that something else is needed in order to explain this demand. Something that would make the sensus communis not only a common sense, but a general sense of community, a sense by virtue of which we take ourselves to belong to a community of judging subjects. That is, she's arguing that the reason we care about the universalization argument is because we want to belong to a community of sense in which we can share our judgments. So the universality comes out as an as-if demand, so that the notion of universal communicability is something like a progress toward a community of judging subjects. So she thinks that the impetus behind the necessity is finally a moral impetus, but a moral impetus not for a moral state, but for having a sense of a community of shared sense. And this goes along with the fact that it's only by sharing our, actually coming to share our judgments, that we know that we are all geared to the world in the same way. So that, how might I put it? So that we are a community, not because of the rules we have to follow, but because of the judgments and feelings we make about the world. So it's a kind of, again, a version of what's called anarchism. That's judging it. So it's that notion. So in her case, the sensus communis is both presupposed and yet to be achieved. It's presupposed cognitively and it's yet to be achieved normatively. And that the experience of art is, or the experience of the beautiful, is the experience of that in between the presupposed and the yet to be achieved. So it both joins us to everyone, we presuppose the possibility of our sharing, and it further enjoins us to further states of sharing. Right? Because otherwise we cannot make sense of our own judgments. Otherwise, we are, our sense of that our judgments are true turns out to be merely idiosyncratic. So that we cannot believe our own judgments unless we are committed to the community of common sense. So she really wants to, this is an interesting anti-Gadamerian account of Kant. Right? Because Gadamer says the problem with Kant is he took the notion of common sense, the Stoic Roman one, where common sense was the shared sensibility of a political community, and internalized it in the subject. Okay, we're done. Subjectivizing of common sense. And what she's doing is re-objectifying it. Okay, we'll pick up there next week.